Right? Kiseitse 1046. Once again, as the as the Dvarim parshas are action packed. What I'm going to try and do, I'm just going to take the first three mitzvahs in this week's parsha, the first three paragraphs, and try and go into them on deeper levels, and also connect it, hopefully, with the month of Elul and the whole preparation to Rosh Hashanah, based on the principle, of course, that the Shalah HaKadosh tells us that when you read parshas of the week in a certain time of the year, by divine providence, by Hashgacha Pratis, there's always got to be some connection to the time that we're in. And therefore the Mefarshim have a lot to speak about these parshas we read during the month of Elul, that they all somehow connected to the preparation to Rosh Hashanah, the whole idea of Tshuva and Elul, etc. Okay. There's some deep concepts to go through, so let's try and master them. Okay, the first parasha, the first mitzvah in the Torah is a very unique, strange mitzvah almost. And it talks about one of the things that has to do with warfare. And the parasha reads as follows. Again, it's page 1046. The parasha says, Kiseitse la milchama aloivecha, when you will go out to war against your enemies, unesonoi Hashem alekecha biyadecha, and Hashem your God will give them, will give the enemy into your hand, v'shavisa shivya, and you will capture captives. Right? You will capture captives. Or you'll take people into captivity. Continues the parasha, v'ra'isa bashivya. You will see in captivity, he's talking of course to the male soldiers, Eishes Yifas Toyer, a beautiful woman, B'choshakta Ba, and you will desire her, B'lokachta Chal Isha, and you will take her for a wife. What this means is, and we'll have to explore in a minute what this means, but the Torah is saying that the Torah is giving permission almost to a soldier who is in the battlefront, who sees a woman that he likes, a non-Jewish woman, mind you, and he takes her for a wife, which means he has a relationship with her. Now he's had a relationship with her and he wants to marry her, right? The Hevesa, I see a few shock faces. It's a very strange mitzvah. We're going to go into it in a minute. The Hevesa Toch Vesecha, you'll bring her to your house. The Gilcha Asroisha, you'll shave her head. V'asa Tziporneo, let her nails grow long. V'asira Simla Shivya, take off the warfare clothing from her, because the Chibura says that the women used to wear very attractive clothing during warfare to give moral support to the men. Yashua Beisecha, she'll sit in your house, and she should cry for her father and her mother for a month. And if you still want to marry her after that, if you still are attracted to her and you still want to marry her, then she can convert. You can live with her and she'll be your wife. However, but if after the month you don't want her, then you need to be human about it. You've got to send her away. You're not permitted to sell her, as there was slavery in those times, but this particular woman is not permitted to be sold, because you captured her, you put her through this misery. So either you marry her or you let her go free. Don't work her hard, because you've afflicted her. Okay. At a very basic level, the Gemara says, what is this mitzvah all about? So at a very, very basic level, the Gemara says that this mitzvah is keneged ha-yetzahara. It's a mitzvah that the Torah gave to satisfy the yetzahara. Meaning, it's one mitzvah that the Torah says that that the person will go to warfare. Soldiers on the battlefront are very vulnerable. The yetzahara is very strong, very, very fragile. And therefore, the Gemara says that if the Torah won't allow this person to live with this non-Jewish woman that he has seen on the battlefront, then he might do it anyway, and therefore as an exception to the rule, we have all kinds of issues here, taking a woman, capturing her, it's a non-Jewish woman, etc., etc., but as an exception to the rule, the Torah permits the soldier to have a relationship with this woman and even to marry her eventually if she converts, because it was like a concession to human weakness. It was a concession to the Yetzer Hara. That's the mitzvah at a very, very basic level. But I'm going to share with you an explanation from the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. Orach Chaim was a... I'll share with you two explanations, actually. One, a deep explanation on the mitzvah, and then an understanding of this mitzvah on a whole different level, on a spiritual level. Now, when I share these things with you, it's always on the understanding that the Torah talks, I've mentioned this many times, that the Torah talks on many levels, right? We have the Torah, we have the mitzvahs in its literal sense, and then we have the Torah speaking simultaneously on a higher level. The Ramban says in one place that the Torah medaberes betachtonim, the Torah talks in language that's applicable on this earth, but umeramezes b'olyonim, but he's hinting and alluding to things that are taking place in the highest spheres, right? In the spiritual level. There's one of the Sifrei Kabbalah, and I forgot his name at the moment, says that actually it's the opposite way around. That really how Torah medaberes b'olyonim, really the Torah's main message is the way things are happening in a spiritual context. And then it alludes to the way things happen down here below. In other words, the Torah originates in its spiritual language, right? So when we talk about a particular parasha, we talk about a mitzvah, and we explain it on a whole different level, we explain it on a spiritual level, right? It doesn't mean that we're taking the mitzvah out of its simple context. In fact, it's the other way around. The Torah has many levels, and in fact, the Torah originates in its spiritual context, in its spiritual terminology, in its spiritual application. And then it's translated into a physical, tangible application. Yeah? Is that, understand that? So therefore, it's not that one pshat is the pshat and the other one is like just a thing that we found in the parasha. They are both absolutely true, just the way the Torah is talking on simultaneously on various different levels. So I'm going to share with you something that Orach Chaim HaKadosh says. Yeah. Orach Chaim was a great makubal. His name was Reb Chaim Ben Attar. Chaim Ben Attar lived in Tzfas around, I think it was about 300 years ago. He was he wrote a fascinating pirush on the Torah called Orach Chaim. In fact, it's hard to define exactly what the style of this commentary is. It's like a combination of medrash, of pshat, of kabbalah, it depends on the paragraph. You know, some commentaries in the Chumash have a style. You can actually sort of tell what their style is. Rashi, like, focuses on pshat, you know, that I'm... the Kli Yoker is very drush. Every commentary has a style. Orach Chaim is a combination of everything. Anyway, on this particular parasha, he quotes an Arizal and he bases his concept on Kabbalah, and he says a fascinating pshat in this mitzvah. And he says the following. First of all, he says it's very, very difficult to understand that the Torah would give a mitzvah as a concession to the Yetzer Hara, if it's just a concession to the Yetzer Hara. He says you have to understand what warfare was. The wars that the Torah is talking about are wars that the Jewish people fought and won miraculously. So in fact, the battlefield in the Torah warfare context was a time of tremendous spiritual revelation. It was a time where you saw the hand of God, right? Yes, they fought physical wars, but they saw tremendous victory, right? The Torah wars that the Torah is describing here. Secondly, he says in last week's parasha, at the end of Shoftim, we have a very clearly defined of what type of soldiers are allowed to go to war. I don't know if you remember from at the end of last week's parasha, it says when they go out to war, there's the judge gets up and he has a speech, right? And he declares, he says like this, whoever is a first-year married should go back. Whoever's planted a vineyard should go back. Whoever's a new house should go back. Then he says, whoever's scared should go back. Right? Can you imagine that bit, right? So the Gemara says, what does it mean, whoever's scared? He's scared because he might have an Aveira. What type of an Aveira? In other words, a person's going out to the battlefield and he might have transgressed, right? So he's scared that he will be punished on the battlefield. Maybe he won't be protected by God's protection because he's got some form of transgression. What type of transgression are we talking about, says the Gemara? Right? We're not talking about necessarily someone who, I don't know, ate treif for Brok Shabbos. We're talking about someone who soch ben tfilo le tfilo. We're talking about men, right? So we're talking about someone when you put on tefillin and you put on the hand tefillin and the head tefillin, and he's supposed to do it one after another without interrupting in between. And this guy maybe spoke in between the hand tefillin and the head tefillin. Something you're not supposed to do, but it's not like, doesn't rate them, you know, from the most serious transgressions. And yet someone who may have violated that transgression was too scared to go to warfare, went back. In other words, who was left? someone who was free of sin, who didn't even talk ever, between tefillin and tefillin, between tefillin shiyah and tefillin shorosh, right? You know, that just to digress for a second, I tell a story. I don't know if it was in the Talmud Chofetz Chaim or one of the other Gedolei Yisrael, where it was very, the Maskilim, the Enlightened movement had become very, very strong. It was like the forerunner of the Reform movement, you could say. Right? And they took out the holiness of the Torah, right? So they say, I think it was the Talmud Chofetz Chaim, that in his town, the Maskilim put on a play. And the play was to make fun of the Torah a little bit. I mean, they were very into learning the Torah from a linguistic point of view and a grammatical point of view, etc., etc. But the kedusha, the holiness, they took out. So they made a play, and they poked fun at the Torah. How do they do that? They made a play of the Yidden going to war, and they had this thing where the guy gets up and he says, "Okay, I've built a house, I go back," and everyone, you know, half the crowd goes back, and everyone goes back eventually. Then he says, whoever does a virus, whoever, you know, spoke between tefillin and tefillin, should go back, and everyone goes back, and there's three old rabbis left there on the battlefield, and they're going out to war, right? That was the fun they were part of. So they tell a story that this story got to the Chofetz Chaim, I think it was the Chofetz Chaim, and he said, it's actually a very good play. He said, they just missed out one detail. The detail of the story was that they went to war and they won. In other words, the Torah gives a very... Because the Torah is warfare. Yes, you've got to fight a natural war, but it's a spiritual war. And therefore, you follow the Torah's guidelines. The Torah promises that they'll win, and they did win, and they saw amazing victories in Jewish history, right? Except for the times, Taka, they didn't do exactly what Hashem wanted. Then people fell. But in the times of Yeshua, when they won the wars properly, when they fought the wars the way Hashem wanted them to, but they saw amazing victories, and they were able to see the hand of Hashem. Says the Aruch Chaim, how could it be that the soldiers left on the battlefield, not just some soldiers, these are guys, the great tzaddikim. These are guys that are free of sin. These are guys that are on a high level that even they haven't even done an avera of talking between the tefillin shel yad and the tefillin shel rosh. And all of a sudden, the guy's such an animal that he sees someone there that he has to have a relationship with, so he can't wait till he gets on. Right? I mean, what's it all about? So he says the following. This is this is revolutionary stuff, okay? So raise yourself. Right, that's it. That's what I meant. Thank you. So he brings from the Arizal a famous concept. The Arizal says the following. That it's well known that when Adam Harishon sinned, there was a trip, right, with the first sin of the tree of knowledge, and there was a tremendous confusion between good and bad. What had happened was as follows. The Zohar says, Kabbalah says, that the 600,000 main categories of souls that were created, right? We know that the Yidden are comprised of 600,000 souls, subdivided into many more, and that's why we have so many more people. But there's 600,000 neshamas, right? Corresponding to the 600,000 letters of the Torah, etc. In fact, you know the word Yisrael stands for Yesh, the word Yisrael, which refers to Jewish people, stands for Yesh Shishim Ribu Oisiyas La Torah. There are 600,000 letters of the Torah, right? For the 600,000 souls, 600,000 letters. These souls were all attached spiritually to Adam Harishon. When Adam Harishon, the first man, was created, the 600,000 souls were all sort of invested in him, and everyone that was going to come out of him was going to receive one of those souls or from the category of one of those souls. Originally, before Adam Harishon sinned, the world was going to reach a state of perfection within minutes, within hours. There would only be Kedusha in the world, right? But that wasn't meant to happen, and Adam Harishon did so. When Adam Harishon sinned, it was a process. Suddenly what happened was that there was a merger between evil and good. Now it goes even deeper. In Kabbalah, in the Zohar, it says that what happened was that the Nochash, when the snake, who was the symbol of evil, came to Chava, he had a relationship with Chava, he actually invested into Chava impurity, klipa, because that was when the world was created, it was created perfect. When the world was created, evil, what we know in Kabbalah as klipa, as the opposite of holiness, was contained within one small creature, and that was the nachash, that was the snake, right? There was only, that's why it was only the snake who was able to convince Adam and Chava to sin, because people were without a yetzer hara, there was no evil in anyone else or in anything else. Hashem did create the entity, the existence of evil, but it was all contained within the snake, right? I'm just repeating to you what the Zohar says and what the result explains. The snake then invested some of that, he injected, we should say, some of that klipa into Chava, in turn had a relationship with Adam, of course, and then Adam was able to absorb some of that klipa. Because of that, Of the 600,000 souls that Adam HaRishon had, many of those souls became captured in the world of impurity. Right? Although many didn't, in other words, when eventually Shais was born, and out of him came Noach, out of him came Avram Avinu, out of him came the Jewish nation absorbed most of those souls. But because there was the merger between good and evil, between purity and impurity, many of those souls became captured in the world of klippa, in the world of impurity. Okay. Incidentally, I'm not going to go into this in great detail, but it also has to do with Evel and Cain, and how Cain then was had a Gilgul into Yisroel and Moshe and the Mitzri, and Moshe Rabbeinu was Evel. And anyway, that's a whole different discussion. I was given strict instruction not to go into detail because some people here come to the Monday morning Chumash here, and my wife's going to go into the Monday morning. So if you want a revision of this, you come Monday morning. Okay. So, anyway, but that's a separate discussion. Okay, but that's how it works. Now, that explains the concept of geirus, the concept of conversion. Because what happens is we find throughout Jewish history that some converts, some geirim, were people who were originally incredibly evil people. I'll give you an example. You know, when the Jewish people came in the land of Israel, Yehoshua married a woman called Rachav. Right? Now Rachav, if you know a bit of Tanakh, was the woman who hosted the two spies that Yehoshua sent. You know, Yehoshua sent spies a second time, who stayed at a house called Rachav. If you look at Tanakh, it says, who was Rachav? She was a Zoyna, which is translated by Mefarshim in two different ways. Either it meant she ran a restaurant, or it means she was a prostitute. Right? She wasn't a very great person, put it that way. Okay? So Rachav, and yet, when Yeshua came into Eretz Yisrael, she converted, she became a tzaddikus. So much so, that out of her came Yirmiyahu. Okay? Out of her came Yirmiyahu. We find there was a Gemara, I've forgotten the name of that person, but there was a Gemara tells me one of the generals, one of the Roman generals that came and committed tremendous atrocities in the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, killed many, many people, was a terrible, terrible person, and then suddenly was aroused to tshuva. Something sparked within him and he became a geri, converted, became a very good person. Out of him came very, very great people. Some of the Tanoim and Amoraim came from this Roman general, right? So you have people who were tremendously low level, and suddenly either them or their children or somehow through the process they became geri, they became converts, and out of them came greatness. Why? What actually happens? Says the Aruch Chaim, based on the Zohar and the Arizal, that what happens is that they contained within them an neshama from Adam HaRishon, that because of the merger between purity and impurity had been captured in the world of evil, in the world of impurity. Sometimes the neshamas were exiled and really absorbed and captured in a world of tremendous impurity. But then, when the time is right and the time comes, these neshamas are able to be redeemed and able to be released and have their tikkun, and they are extracted from the world of impurity and breed tremendously positive and pure results. Okay? And this happens in many ways. So, for example, there's a fascinating piece of Arizal on the story of Shechem and Dinah. Right, you know what I'm talking about, the story of Shechem and Dinah? Right. So, if you have a look at the story of Shechem and Dinah, what happened was as follows. I'll take you back a little bit. Okay. Probably this is going to be a little bit different. Parshas Vayishlach. Hold on a second, I'll just tell you the page. Okay. Page 182.
Can I just ask you,
you
see that after
Rahab
came?
You're Miyahu Anavi. Who was there? Jeremiah the prophet.
Jeremiah.
Yeah.
Sorry, what page did you say that?
182. Okay, so we have the story of Dinah. Dinah goes and she's violated by Shechem. Okay? Shechem's father then comes to Yaakov and says, if you ever look at the second line, Vayedaber Chamor itom leimer, Chamor spoke to Yaakov and his son saying, Shechem b'ni choshko nafshoi bevitche. Shechem, my son, his soul desires your daughter Dina. Tnu no isa loyla isha. Can please let him marry. What actually happens at the end? Yaakov and his sons talk the Shechem and the town into circumcising, and then they kill him. Okay? Now, on a simple level, Shimon Levi did the wrong thing. Yaakov wasn't very, very happy, but at the end of the day, Shimon Levi remained tzaddikim. And therefore, according to the Arizal, this story was meant to happen. So listen to this. You see a little bit later. They go and they talk to their town. They convince them to convert or whatever. And there's a line there where some, I'm trying to find the line. Give me 1 second. Oh, the bottom line of that, page 182. They say, you know, these people are perfect. We can do business with them. And then it says, V'ha'oretz, the last line, it says, V'ha'oretz, hinei rachavas yodayim lifneihem. There is ample room in the land for them. In other words, we can live together. And they use the word rachavas yodayim. Rachavas yodayim. So there's a famous Arizal that says, right, the Arizal, we know, one of the things that Arizal did in his works, he revealed to us many of the secrets behind reincarnations and Gilgulim and which neshamas are connected with which neshamas. It's a fascinating thing. The word rachavas, see this? Rachavas stands for Rab Chanina ben Tradyoim. Rab Chanina ben Tradyoim was one of the great sages of the Gemara, of the Tanaim. He was one of the 10 martyrs. So how does Rab Chanina ben Tradyoim come in here? So according to Kabbalah, what happened was as follows. Shechem possessed one of those captured neshamas. Right? Shechem possessed one of those captured neshamas.
Of evil.
Of good.
Of good.
Shechem himself was evil, but he possessed, he had absorbed, he was impure, but he had absorbed one of those good neshamas that had been captured and exiled into the world of impurity. Right? Sometimes what happens is, says the Arachayim and the Arizal, that when those captured neshamas can lay dormant in a person for many, many decades or centuries, and then sometimes when it comes into contact with Kedusha, it reignites because it's attracted to the world of Kedusha. And that's what happened, that when Dina crossed Shechem's path, that neshama was activated, that it became incredibly connected to Dina and needed to be released. But in that case, what happened was, and we'll see why in a second, Shechem didn't convert. He got killed at the end, right? Because sometimes the evil in which the neshama resides is so bad that it cannot be elevated, that evil. It has to be cut off, has to be severed. So what happened was, that neshama that was in Shechem, that was attracted to Dina, through the whole story of Dina and Shechem, we are taught that it was extracted from Shechem through Dina and through her brothers. And then when that neshama was extracted from Shechem and through the circumcision, and when it was extracted from Shechem, Shechem then died because he himself could not be elevated. And that neshama was given to that great tzaddik, Rab Chanina ben Tradyan. That's what that result tells us. So Rab Chanina ben Tradyan was the neshama of Shechem. Okay? Now, what am I telling you this?
Purify.
Yeah, purify. Sorry? I told you it's going to be wild stuff. Well, because it was a package deal, right? No. So what happened was, right, so he was attracted. The problem was that he wasn't conscious of why he was attracted to her, right? He was attracted to her actually for something actually positive, because the neshama needed and was yearning for things. But the problem is that he was the world of impurity, and therefore he expressed that attraction by violating it, right? But the deeper side behind the violation was actually the beginning, the origin of it was actually that attraction between the two souls, right? So what does that mean? Says the Aruch Chaim the following. These captured souls get their tikkun, are released, are redeemed, one of two ways. Either the captured soul is able to activate itself and elevate the environment in which it resides, which explains the story of why people convert. So that explains Rochav, it explains that your general, explains Unculus, it explains Rus. Rus, for example, is also, she was a Moabite princess. She wasn't in a very good environment, right? But her neshama was so strong that it could elevate the environment of Rus, and therefore Rus converted, and she was able to keep that neshama. and therefore the whole of her was able to convert, and the neshama was, had its tikkun, had its redemption through elevating the impure environment in which it resided. Right? That's one way. But sometimes it's more like the story of Shechem. Sometimes more the story of Shechem, that the neshama cannot elevate the environment in which it's in. It needs to be extracted. And therefore, like the story of Shechem, the relationship with Dinah was enough to extract the neshama, but Shechem himself could not be elevated, therefore he was killed, and the neshama then had its tikkun by being given to Rab Chanina ben Tradion, which is hinted in the word Rachavas Yadayim, says the Arizal. Okay. Says the Ara Chaim, this is now the secret behind the story of this mitzvah. Right? What happens is, the soldier goes to war. Who is the soldier? The soldier is a tremendous tzaddik. Talking person who never even spoke between Tefillin Shel Yad and Tefillin Shel Rosh. Right? Says the Torah, you're going to go out to war, and it may happen that you will find an Eishes Yifas Torah, an attractive woman. What is it referring to? It's talking about the neshama, not the person. Eishes Yifas Torah means you will find someone who you are attracted to, and the reason might be because, or the reason will be in your case, says the Torah, because we're talking about a tzaddik, the reason will be because there's a neshama, a captured neshama there, needing to be redeemed. And therefore, in the context of the warfare, you will have a relationship with her, and that relationship will attach you to the neshama. Okay? Says the Rechaim, however, the Torah says, you will not know, however, what type of captured neshama it is. Is it a neshama that can elevate its surroundings in which it resides? Or is it a neshama that needs to be extracted? So what should you do? You've got to give it a month. You got to see what happens to this person. You got to take her and let her be there in your house for a month and see if she can convert afterwards. If the process that you put her through allows her afterwards to convert and to become a proper Giyoris, that's a simon, that's a sign that neshama is one of those captured neshamas who can then elevate the environment in which it resides and therefore can elevate the whole of her and she can become a proper Giyoris and you can continue living with her. If not, then you know that you've just extracted the neshama, but the rest of her has to go. You know that I mistreat her. She's a person, she's a human being. You cannot sell her, you cannot afford anything. You've let her go, and she goes, she's free, and she does whatever she wants to do, but she doesn't convert because obviously she wasn't able to. And therefore that neshama had to be extracted. That's the Aruch Chaim's take on the mitzvah of the Eishes Yifas Torah. A little bit of a different angle. On another note, there's another explanation on this mitzvah, which the Arizal also and the Zohar connect this mitzvah with Elul. Okay, and they say, and this is again what I said before, that the mitzvah actually is not even talking about warfare. It's talking about a completely different war. It's talking about, again, the Torah talks simultaneously on various levels. So the Arizal explains that this in another place that this portion of the Torah is actually referring to the war between the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. Okay. And this is the way it goes. Listen to the way. Let's reread it. Reread it differently. It says like this. Sorry, page 1046 again, right? When you're going to go out to war on your enemy. In other words, you will understand that the relationship between you and the Yetzer Hara is a challenge. It is a war. It's a war. However, you need to go out with confidence. You need to begin that war by understanding, you need to understand that you will capture, you will win this war. In other words, the war between the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, between the body and soul, is a winnable war. It's a war possible to win. It's not easy, it's a challenge, but you can win it. Vera'isa bashivya, however, you will see, says the Torah, you might find that in the process of the captivity, you will find Eishes Yifas Torah. You will find a beautiful woman, referring to the neshama. In other words, sometimes what happens in this war, that the wrong side wins. The neshama gets captured. We find that we sit and we reflect on, talking about Elul, we reflect on the year gone by, and we see maybe instead of us capturing the world and the Yetzer Hara, the world has captured us and the neshama is in trouble. The neshama is captured. Okay. So what do you got to do? So it says you got to, and you want to redeem this neshama. What's the process of the redemption? Says the Arizal, the process of the redemption is a process of tshuva. And it's an amazing thing. We always read Parshas Kiseitzeh in Chodesh Elul, in the month of Elul. Says the Arizal, it says you've got to take this woman to your house. Uvochsa esavia ve'es ima yerach yomim. And she shall cry for her father and her mother for a month. Says the Arizal, that month is the month of Elul. It's the month of tshuva. That process of she should cry for her mother and father for a month is the idea, the reflection of tshuva. And what tshuva is associated on some level with crying, meaning tshuva is a process of simcha, but it's also a process where you feel uncomfortable about the past, you regret the past, you go through and reflect on the distance that we've created between us and Hashem so that we should be able to reconnect. Says the Arizal, what's the pshat that she has to cry for her father and for her mother? So there's a very important lesson when it comes to doing tshuva. And this, of course, is month of Elul, where we do tshuva. Says this: there's male and female, there's father and mother. We know that the relationship between Hashem and Yidden is like between a husband and wife, right? We can talk about this in the next mitzvah as well. So it's between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Neshamas. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is called the father, and Yidden are called the mother. It's a marriage between husband and wife. Says the Arizal, when a person does tshuva in the month of Elul, when he takes the Neshama that's being captured, and for a month, Yerach Yomim, for the 30 days of Elul, the neshama is doing tshuva. Tshuva has to be on two levels. It's got to be both with regard to the mitzvahs which are between us and Hashem, between Adam Lamokon, the spiritual mitzvahs. That means the neshama crying for a father, right? And it's also got to be the neshama crying for the mother, which is other yidden, which is Knesset Yisrael, which is Bnei Yisrael, and that's got to be the tshuva on mitzvahs ben Adam Lachaveri. Like the Rambam says in the laws of tshuva, that tshuva has to be complete. The person cannot only pick one area of tshuva; otherwise, that's not real change. Real change means I'm able to reflect on the whole package of my connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And my connection with Hashem includes both the mitzvahs that I have to do, how I daven, how I learn, how I make brachas, how I keep the halacha, how I keep Shulchan Aruch, etc., etc. It also has to include the middos and relationships and how we relate to other people. Both components have to come into the formula and the process of tshuva. And that's the deeper meaning, the spiritual meaning of this mitzvah, that you go out to war, you fight this war between you and the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. Sometimes an Hashemah gets captured, it needs to be redeemed. The redemption process is through tshuva. And Hashem gives us a special month, Yerach Yomim, the 30 days, in order to do that, which is the 30 days of Elul. And in those 30 days, there has to be the process of both the mitzvahs between man and God, the mitzvah between man and man, and that's Esavia, that's Ima, the father and the mother. That's the deeper pshat in this mitzvah. Okay. Let's go on to the next mitzvah. Next mitzvah has to do with the laws of inheritance. Also a difficult mitzvah to understand. Says the Torah the following. First three mitzvahs in this Torah, on this parasha, are very difficult mitzvahs to understand. Says the Torah, Ki siyena le'ish tei nashim. If a man will have two wives, one he loves, and the one he doesn't love so much. Or he hates. Yolde le'ivonim. And they will bear children, or bear sons, both the loved one and the not so loved one. And it happens, that the firstborn is born to the wrong wife. It's born to the one he doesn't like. Now, there will come a time where he'll have to bequeath it, he'll have to provide inheritance for his children. And the Torah is going to tell us that the halacha is, halacha with inheritance, I'll explain in a second, is that the sons inherit a father, but the halacha is that the firstborn, you know, that's in the halacha of inheritance, the firstborn takes double. Right? Pishnai. Yeah, you familiar with that? Yeah. No? That's what Torah says. So he says, Lo yuchel levaker es beno ahuva, you're not allowed to give preference to the firstborn of the loved wife, al pei ben asnu habachar, over the firstborn of the despised wife. Because you shall recognize the firstborn of the not so loved wife, loses like pishnayim to give him double. Because he is the first of your strength, he's your firstborn. He deserves to have the law of firstborn. So this is just give us enough halachic enough of what it's all about. Okay, so we know in the Torah there are very strict laws of inheritance. In other words, the way it works is when a person passes away, there's this process, there's a particular formula of inheritance that the Torah provides for people. Now, that doesn't mean that a person cannot do it differently, but halachically, if a person wants to do it differently, it has to be done in a special way. A person has a right to distribute his possessions or his assets or what he owns to his children in whichever way he wants to do it, provided he does it when he's still alive. He gives it as a present. Right? So just before, when a person's old, a person can designate certain things to go to certain children by way of matana. But if a person doesn't specify, if a person doesn't designate it, and a person passes on, the Torah provides the particular process of inheritance. Okay. Incidentally, this is a very fascinating halachic problem that comes up today, of, and it's discussed among the poskim. I don't want to go into that in too much length, but it's a very interesting topic of how one writes a will that should be halachically correct. Right? Because a standard will actually would normally distribute what a person owns not in accordance to the laws of inheritance. And the question is a person permitted to do that? Because what he's doing is, even though it might be legally appropriate, but it's really going against the Torah. The Torah says that you have to follow particular laws of inheritance. And there's a lot of discussion on how one does that and how you can get around it. One of the strategies that's used is to write an accompanying halachic document together with the will. Many people do this actually, when they write a will, and the will normally doesn't follow the exact laws of inheritance of the Torah, because just things are different today, and the context is different, the person's desires might be different, etc. What the person can do is, he can write an accompanying halachic document that allows whatever he wants to happen in the will to take halachic effect just before he passes on. You understand what I'm saying? Like, so that the shtar, the halachic document, can stipulate that whatever he gave, whatever he distributes in his will, actually is binding and takes effect the moment before death. Okay? So that's how it's going to happen. Anyway, but that's not the point of this discussion. The point of discussion is in the context. Now, the Torah says, for whatever reason is, the Torah says that if a person has a number of sons, so the sons inherit the father, and the firstborn takes double. So, for example, if there's four sons, you'd have to take whatever he's worth and divide it into five, not four, divide it into five. The firstborn takes 2/5, and everyone else takes 1/5. Okay? There's all kinds of reasons for this. Some pick a bola, the person, you know, because it says also in the Torah, when it comes to honoring parents, it says, we learn in the Gemara that a person is obligated to also honor the oldest brother, because apikabola, the life energy of the children comes from the parents through the firstborn son, and therefore he's got sort of certain preference, and there's all kinds of different structures of why that is. Okay. However, the main problem with this is as follows. If the Torah wanted to teach us a halacha that a firstborn needs to get double, why does the Torah choose such almost a morbid circumstance to teach us this halacha? In other words, why doesn't the Torah just teach us the halacha straight? When a person has children, his firstborn son must get the double. Doesn't matter where the firstborn son comes from, which wife it comes from, it's not relevant, right? Why does the Torah have to paint a picture of a person has two wives, one he likes and one he doesn't like, and the firstborn happens to be from the other one, and therefore he wants to give preference to the... And now that I do that, I mean, it's simple. If the Torah would just tell us that whatever happens, you have a firstborn son, your firstborn son gets double under all circumstances, it will be clear. Right? Why does the Torah have to give it in such a very sort of negative context, negative sense? But here again, I share with you one of the explanations that emphasizes the point that sometimes the Torah needs to be read on a different level. Right? In other words, the halacha is clear the way it is. But the reason why it's given in this context, perhaps, is because the Torah is also speaking on a whole different level also. And this is explained in a number of sources, how this actually works. And once again, it has a tremendous connection to the time of year and the month of Elul that we're in. Right? And it goes like this. We know that the relationship between God and the Jewish people is a marriage. Hashem is the husband, we are the wife, right? Kadosh Baruch Hu is the husband and Hashem is the wife. So we learn there are two types of relationships. Hashem has two types of wives. There's the Shamas that he likes and the Shamas that are not so lovable. Why? There are those people that the love between them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is constant. Tzaddikim, great, pure people. They never waver, they never fail. Their attachment, their connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is incredible. Their holiness is an amazing level. It's burning, it's passionate, it's always there, it's consistent. And the relationship that exists between them and Hashem is amazing. That's one type of neshama. That's one type of life, wife, and that's the ahuva, that's the beloved wife that the Torah is referring to. But then there's the other wife, the other type of neshama, the other type of person, which I think is probably most of us, right? And that's what the Torah refers to as the snua. Why is it snua? Because it's the neshama that has challenges, as we can all relate to. It's the neshama that doesn't always feel connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That the love relationship between the neshama and Hashem isn't so strong. That the person fails, they do things wrong, they sometimes go up, they sometimes go down. It's a very inconsistent, unstable relationship almost. It's a neshama that's full of tension, full of challenges, full of difficulties, always trying to navigate their way through the temptations of life, through the hurdles of life, through the indulgences of life. It's very, very difficult, and you cannot refer to that neshama and say that that marriage between that neshama and Hashem is one of ahuva, it's a beloved wife. It's not. It's a strained relationship, it's a difficult relationship. Says the Torah, you might think that the greater outcome, the greater product, the greater accomplishment will be in the beloved wife, in the relationship between the pure neshama and Hashem. Says the Torah, it's not true. You know where the firstborn is going to come out of? You know which wife is going to give birth to that son, to that product which is greater and achieves the purpose of creation in a much more emphasized way and brings much greater and deeper spiritual results? The challenged neshama, not the tzaddik. Which is, of course, the whole concept of tshuva. It's the neshama that has a challenge, and yet is able once in a while to overcome that challenge. And when the neshama is not able to overcome the challenge, it goes through a process of tshuva, and it uses that negativity and uses the failing as a catalyst to come back even stronger, to reconnect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in even a deeper way. That neshama yields much deeper results than the pure neshama. The bechor, the firstborn, comes out of not the ahuva neshama, but comes out of the snua neshama. And therefore when Hashem, on the day that Hashem rewards His children, so to speak, on the day that Hashem gives inheritance to His children, the pishnaim, the double, goes to the ben ha-becher, the double goes to the child of the snua, right? Which of course is in line with the whole idea of tshuva. We have this story that I've told many times, that the Gemara tells about Rabbi Lazar ben Dudaya. Who was Rabbi Lazar ben Dudaya? Lazar ben Dudaya was a gangster. And he had committed every transgression in the book, right? He was a very, very immoral person. And one time he actually paid money, and he invested money to go have a relationship with an immoral woman. It's like, well, it tells the whole story. At the end, he was there with her, far away from his place and far away from his hometown. And he, in the middle of the whole relationship, she said something to him like, you know, your life is pretty empty. And suddenly something ignited within him, and he realized like what he'd done with his life. He realized how far he was from Hashem, right? And he was aroused to an incredible level of tshuva. So it says that he went and sat between two mountains, and he cried with such a yearning to reconnect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that his neshama left his body. That's how strong his tshuva was. Right? And when his neshama left his body, there was a heavenly voice that came out, a baskal that came out, and said, "Welcome, Rebbe Lazar ben Dudaya." Right? He was like completely wiped clean, and he was welcomed into Gan Eden. Once we're on revolutionary thing, I'll just share with you, actually, just digress a minute. It wasn't that simple, apparently, because apparently even you do tshuva, when you come into Gan Eden, you have to have some mitzvahs, because mitzvahs are the protection that allow you to I mean, the bottom line is he's a shaman, he reached a credible level of purity, but he didn't have actually the tools to absorb Gan Eden. So in Kalpi Kabbalah, what happened was, that, you know, there was another fellow called Rabbi Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Rabbi Yochanan Kohen Gadol was a Kohen Gadol for 80 years. He was a big tzaddik, and then he became a rosh, he became a tzaddik, he became a Sadducee. Right? So when Yochanan Kohen Gadol passed away, he couldn't be led into Gan Eden because he messed up at the end of his life, right? But nevertheless, you know, mitzvahs are eternal. So his mitzvahs were put on hold. So what happened was, apparently, when Rabbi Lazar ben Dudaya died, when he did the tshuva and his neshama reached such an unbelievable level, that he needed mitzvahs to get into Gan Eden, he was given the 80 years of mitzvahs from Rabbi Yochanan Kohen Gadol to be able to gain access to Gan Eden. Okay, that's a separate, just a side point. Okay.
Borrowed.
Huh?
Borrowed
mitzvahs, that's right. Right? Okay, so... So it says in the Gemara an amazing thing, right? It says in the Gemara an amazing thing that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rebbe, the author of the Mishnah, who was known as Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the holy rabbi, a person who was holy from day one, when he heard the story, he heard it, I guess he heard the heavenly voice, or he understood what happened, he cried. Why did he cry? He said, Yesh koyna elama b'sha achas. He says, certain people are able to reach that madrega in one moment. So the Mefarshim explained, what was Rebbe's real problem? Rebbe cried because Rebbe knew, it's an amazing thing, that as holy as he was, there was a certain level of passion and connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he would not be able to reach, that Rebbe Elazar ben Nedaya did reach. Right? Why? Because sometimes there's a love of Hashem and a strength of reconnection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that can only be achieved through challenge and through distance. Rebbe Elazar ben Nedaya, when he felt so far away, his burning desire to reconnect and overcome the challenge of being far away was so strong that Rebbe Yehuda Nasi couldn't reach that level of Avas Hashem. He couldn't reach that level of connection. Why? Because he was always holy. Everything was smooth by him. He never had that adrenaline of the soul. He never had that extra strength. Because there's a connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that can be achieved through overcoming and transforming negativity and challenge that cannot be achieved by holiness alone. And this is not a recommendation to sin, God forbid. But nevertheless, that is the concept of tshuva, right? That is the idea of tshuva, and that's why the Gemara says that where a true Baal tshuva stands, even a tzaddik cannot come close to that level. And that's what the Torah is telling us in this parasha. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu has two wives, the Ahuva and the Snua, the Neshama that's pure like Rabbeinu HaKadosh, that everything's going glatt. But then there's the Snua, the Neshama that's full of challenges, where it doesn't seem so holy, and it's full of failings, and full of this, and back and forth. Says the Torah, you want to know the truth? Of Hoya Ben HaBechor, the firstborn is going to be born to the Snua, not to the Ahuva. Because the Neshama, when we look back at a year, we might have messed up, but through the process of tshuva, we can achieve a level that's not possible without that process. So the power of overcoming a challenge, overcoming, connecting to Hashem through being a Snua, is even much greater than the other wife. And that's the deeper pshat in this mitzvah. Very quickly, let's cover the third mitzvah, which also will connect to the concept of tshuva. Also an interesting mitzvah, right? This is the mitzvah of the rebellious son. So the mitzvah says like this, ben I think the word I'm about to tell you, actually I've told you before, but anyway, it doesn't matter. Gielish ben if the person will have a rebellious son, right? And then he doesn't listen to his father, doesn't listen to his mother, they punish him. Okay, I'm going to say it outside just because it's getting late. So, essentially, the Torah gives this very strange mitzvah of Ben Sori Remeira, the son who has done everything wrong. He's stolen meat and stolen wine and robbed and anyway. And they've tried him and they've done this and they've warned him and nothing helped. And he's 13 years old. And the Torah says he gets stoned, he gets killed. Right? Why does he get killed? He didn't actually do anything that's deserving of capital punishment. Says the Gemara. Says the Gemara, because he obviously reached the level of no return, and therefore, rather kill him now when he's innocent, rather than wait till he messes up really badly. Very strange idea, right? The Gemara says a very strange thing. First of all, let me just find here the quote.
Especially if we sell, can we be made pure?
So listen to this. So there's a dispute in the Gemara. Rav Shimon says that the halacha of Ben Sorer Umayra never happened. Never happened, never will happen. Why? He says because really, if you actually look at the halachas of this mitzvah, they are so impractical that actually probably can never happen. The odds are it will never happen. First of all, it's got to be 100,000 things have to happen for this actually to take place, or pi halacha. Meaning, first of all, it says the father and mother have to be the same height physically. They've got to speak with one voice. It's only a window of 3 months that this can happen. There's a certain age of 3 months that this can take place. The guy's got to steal a certain amount of wheat and a certain amount of wine. He's got to do certain things. It's only in all these conditions are met, then this halacha is applied. So the Torah gives us a mitzvah where, in practical terms, the odds are that it could never happen, and says Rav Shimon, it never happened, never will happen. That's one opinion in the Gemara. Comes along Rabbi Yonason, also another sage of the Gemara, and says, no, what are you talking about? This is what he says. He doesn't say it happened. He says, Ani Yoshafti. He says, there was a case of Ben Sori Remeira. I saw him. Vani Yoshafti al Kivroi. And I sat on his grave. So he says, I sat on his grave. So a number of questions here. First of all, according to Rav Shimon, the story can never happen. So why on earth would the Torah give us the mitzvah? Why would the Torah give us a mitzvah that can never happen? If it has no practical relevance, why give it to us in the first place? Question one. Question two, we have a principle that we always try and avoid. You know, we have many, many halachic disputes in the Gemara. Many, hundreds. And that's legitimate. That's part of the process. However, we try to always interpret the Gemara in such a way that we'll never have what we call a machlekes b'metzias, a factual argument. It's very, very different if you say, this is permissible, this is prohibited. That's an argument, halachic argument. But it's unimaginable to have a dispute where you say, this happened and this didn't happen. Right? Either happened or didn't happen. I mean, it's a fact. Right? It's a very difficult thing to comprehend. We have a dispute in a historic fact. Happened or didn't happen. You could have that sometimes, but it's very difficult to understand. They would argue like that. This one says it never ever happened. This one says, oh, you're talking about I saw the grave. So they wanted to do research and go find out. Why does Rav Shimon go find out? Do the research in the archives. Maybe Taka the grave is right. I mean, why do they argue like that? Right? When two people have an argument in halacha, so it's two perspectives, and we say that both perspectives are legitimate. But when you talk about a historic fact, to do the research. Why are you arguing in a fact? Right? Third question is that Rav Yonason says, I saw it and I sat on his grave. Can you explain to me what Rabbi Yonason was doing on the grave of Ben Sarah murder? If he wants to say, I saw, I was at the funeral, maybe, but why are you at the grave? Why are you visiting graves of Ben Sarah murder for? Right? So I saw a number of years ago an incredible explanation, from someone that's still alive, actually. He's a Rav in Borough Park. He's a bit of a Kabbalist. I don't know exactly what he is. He runs a big group in Borough Park called the Munasi Techo, and he has wild stuff on the Chumash. And this is one of the explanations he gives. And it's fascinating. He says, no, there's never a dispute here, and with one approach, he answers all the questions. He says the following. He says, the Torah gives us a mitzvah that can never happen to teach us a lesson. What is the essence of this mitzvah? The essence of the mitzvah is the Torah packages a mitzvah where apparently someone has reached the point of no return. Okay? Now, if it would be true that someone would really reach a point of no return, so then Taka, why let him carry on and mess up really badly? Get rid of him now. So what does the Torah do? The Torah presents to you a scenario where there's a person that fell to a point of no return, but then the Torah says, I'll make it so difficult for this mitzvah to happen, it'll never happen. Why does the Torah do that? So he says the Torah does it specifically to teach us a lesson that there is no such thing of an neshama at a point of no return. It doesn't exist that a person that has a neshama should be at a point of no return. That is simply impossible. No matter how low a person can fall, there's always a point of return. There's always a concept of tshuva. And that lesson the Torah teaches by structuring a theoretical scenario of a person that has sunk to a level of no return, and the Torah says, it'll never happen. And that's what Rav Shimon says, that Ben Tzomer never happened, never will happen, because it's impossible. There's no such thing of a person no return. Okay? Comes along Rabbi Yonason and he agrees. Yonason says, you're absolutely right. I'm going to prove to you a point. Because says Rabbi Yonason, this is what he says, an amazing crowd. I remember Ben Sarumar. I remember a rebellious child like that. I remember someone who had sunk to very low levels at the point where it appeared that he was at no return. However, the halacha didn't allow him to be convicted, because the halacha never allows a person to be convicted, because it's impossible for this to happen. And he did tshuva, and he became a tremendous tzaddik. V'ani yashavti al kibro, and I went to his grave as you visit a grave of a tzaddik. I saw the Ben Sora Rumeire, v'ani yashavti al kibro, I sat on his grave. Because there's a concept of being, like Kolev went to the graves of Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. V'ani yashavti al kibro, I went to his grave. I prayed at his grave, because he became a tzaddik. Just to prove your point, that he appeared to be a Ben Sora Rumeire, he was on the track to being convicted, as the Torah says. It couldn't have happened because it's impossible to happen. And the Torah's lesson was proven right, because Taka, he did tshuva, and he came back, and so they don't argue in a fact. It's not a factual argument. They both agree it never happened. The reason that the Torah gives us mitzvah is to teach us that lesson, and he sat on the grave because he was a tzaddik, and therefore he went to visit the grave of a tzaddik. And again, of course, that's connected to Chodesh El. No matter how bad we think the past year was, the power of tshuva is tremendous. Because a person should never ever give up. A person always has to come back, because tshuva can fix everything. I always tell that story. I've told the story before. There was once a tzaddik who think, who was it? Rabbi Yochanan, one of the Chassidic Rebbes, I've forgotten his name. Mm-hmm. You know that Tzaddikim used to play chess once in a while because it was sharp in the mind, right? Well known throughout the ages. But he said he refused to play chess. Why did he refuse to play chess? He said because when they taught him the rules of chess, they taught him that when you make a move and you take away your hand, it's a wrong move, you can't retract, you can't go back. And he says he knows that tshuva can fix anything. Mm-hmm. So he refused to play chess.